You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 9th of August 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan of Turkey makes his first visit abroad since staring down an attempted coup, and it's to Russia. My guests Daniela Peled and Robert Fox will be here to discuss that and the day's other top stories, including the UK's accelerating backpedaling over the Hinkley Point C nuclear reactor, the early diplomatic subtexts of the Rio Olympics, and can you really claim asylum by accident, or has one Chinese backpacker just hit upon an ingenious ruse for securing a couple of weeks free room and board? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24, live from London right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are Daniela Peled, Managing Editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting and contributor to Haaretz, among others, and Robert Fox, Defence Editor of the Evening Standard. Welcome both. And we will start tonight with that diplomatic outreach by President Recep Tayyip Erdogan of Turkey in the direction of President Vladimir Putin of Russia. On the face of it, this does seem an unlikely initiative. After all, Vladimir Putin is an increasingly tyrannical autocrat, so it's difficult to imagine what points of common interest the pair could possibly find to talk about. Also, there was that thing where Turkey shot down a Russian fighter jet last year and Russia retaliated with sanctions. Robert, first of all, Erdogan has taken a trip abroad following an aborted coup, so that's confident, isn't it?
Yes, and we've talked a lot about that coup on Monocle.
We have.
We'll park that for a minute, but I still think there's something funny about it. Now, why he and Mr. Putin? They have a lot in common. They have interests in common. Putin was the first to contact him after it was clear that he was safe and sound, after this strange coup, let's call it, this rather strange piece of theatre that happened. There are difficulties which both men do recognise they have to get settled, particularly over Syria, over Europe, over which way they orientate themselves, but they have a lot in common. I'm looking at a piece on the new ideology of the Cold War about Putin by Jochen Bittner in the New York Times, in which he talks about a new concept of orderism, which I think we're going to hear a lot more about.
Orderism.
Orderism is a thing that Putin expands and increasingly Erdogan expands. It's where you've got to have order. Doesn't matter about the law, doesn't matter about democracy so much, it's order. And Bittner traces
or it. One assumes order at home coupled and balanced with a certain amount of useful chaos abroad.
Well, that's right. But the chaos for both, just to finish, is very awkward now on Turkey's border and with Mr. Assad, because nobody's script is really going to plan there. And particularly as we have very recently had a big propaganda push against Putin's Russia from ISIS, I think they've got to. There's a lot of settling that's going on. There's a lot of trade, Russian-Turkish trade, that has to be fixed. And I think this is serious. And I think that they are making sure that, you know, they can pick up the red telephone to each other.
Daniela, will Erdogan's visit to St. Petersburg be regarded with unalloyed joy in the capitals of Turkey's fellow NATO allies?
Well, no, to, you know, the brief answer, but it will be pretty popular at home, considering how badly Turkey has suffered from the rift between Russia and Turkey, certainly over tourism, which has had an enormous effect. Turkey's foreign policy has changed dramatically over the last decade, from a point where the idea was to be friends with all of its neighbours and to have good relations with anyone and everyone, and to have this kind of weird parity of relations with people who didn't necessarily get on with each other. And the last 5 years has seen that completely collapse. But rebuilding ties are definitely in both countries' interests. And this is not, I mean, I can think of recent examples, for instance, Israel's ties with Turkey, which were in an absolutely atrocious state, and they were very key allies. In 2010, Israeli forces killed 9 activists on the Mavi Marmara boat going to break the Gaza blockade. This was a diplomatic disaster, lots of grandstanding. In the end, very recently, Israel apologised, paid $20 million in compensation to the families concerned. And although it's not quite back to, you know, the warmest of relations, but certainly there's a move towards business as usual. And that's completely in both parties' interest, even though it's a little bit embarrassing because they were declaring, you know, the respective sides complete evil, as they were with Russia and Turkey. But hey, you know, it's business.
Well, and indeed, no, as we've discussed many times in similar contexts, no permanent friends, no permanent enemies, just permanent interests, etc.
There was one permanent enemy, which it hasn't been coming up too much in the headline, whom will be a subject of, I think, a lot of off-record discussion, and that'll be the Kurds. I think that Erdogan is... This is a main effort, and I think that he will be warning off Putin about this is what we're really going to be doing in northern Syria, because it does seem to be coming to some sort of culminating point there. They want to deal with the Kurds. The Kurds are an awkward thorn in their flesh. The thing is that we tend to dismiss the fight with the PKK, whether you're the army, now much discredited, or the Erdogan supporters. They take that deadly seriously, and they would probably see it, even compared with ISIS at times, as the number one security threat.
The Kurds aside, though, how significant are Turkey's and Russia's differences over Syria? Is it possible they could end up more or less on the same side?
I think that's where what they're doing today. I think they will try to establish common ground there, because look at the fight. This is part of an illustration of what I was saying about the script not going to anybody's pre-planning. Aleppo is a huge problem. It's becoming an ulcer for all sides. And I think that there will be much discussion about that. There will be much discussion about intelligence sharing, of course. That's going to make NATO squeak. But Putin has offered this before with NATO elements, NATO allies involved in the area. But that will be a very big area. I think one of the things that quite simply that is driving everybody to serious thought is that this conflict shows absolutely no sign of ending at all. And it could be, your St. Petersburg question to Daniel was, I thought, right on it, because NATO, EU are getting really itchy about the rumblings about the deal over the refugees. And Erdogan and his government today and yesterday, have been making some very, very threatening noises about calling it off.
Final thought on this one, Daniela, for all the... I mean, there are probably any number of reasonable reservations you could probably come up with at the spectacle of Recep Tayyip Erdogan and Vladimir Putin sitting down and deciding to be friends with each other. But isn't it better than having Turkey and Russia at loggerheads, which would appear to be dangerous for all sorts of reasons?
Well, that's a very difficult question to answer, because you're asking whether it'd be better to be boiled alive in oil or, you know, drowned in an icy ravine. When it comes to Syria, I agree that there's no end anywhere near in sight. And I think that Turkey does seem to be thinking about shifting its foreign policy as regards that. And it will be a policy of containment. I mean, it will be very tough for Turkey to make its peace with an Assad regime. But they have to be pragmatic. I mean, the thing that both sides have in common right now, one of the major diplomatic things is how alienated they are from the West. And Turkey's place in NATO is secure. There's absolute fury with Europe and America, the reaction to the coup, or the reaction to the reaction to the coup, and how enormous waves of disapproval. And Russia is not even playing the game anymore, or playing lip service to the game. It's just operating there out on its own. So an alliance between the two, I think it's clearer to know what it means in economic terms than in geopolitical terms right now.
Okay, well, let's move along now and look closer to home at the UK, where a different diplomatic reset might presently be underway. The previous Conservative government here, led by David Cameron and George Osborne, made very little secret of its ambitions of a profitably close relationship with China, up to and including inviting the People's Republic to help build a new nuclear power station at Hinkley Point in Somerset. But the new Conservative government, led by Theresa May, appears to have allowed the always interesting question, what could possibly go wrong, to be uttered out loud, and is therefore reconsidering. Daniela, first of all, should the UK reconsider Hinkley Point C?
Well, it's a little bit late. you know, this is very much at the last minute. And if they're going to reconsider it, then what alternatives are they going to come up with? I mean, Britain needs foreign capital investment, and putting the kibosh on a scheme like this, right when we've just apparently, horrifically, voted in a referendum to leave the European Union, makes you think, so, well, you know, whither the British economy? If we're going to shut ourselves off from that market, because make no mistake about it, the Chinese are furious and will be furious and will not be coy about making this known and making the effects known. Well, what then? And the French equally are very annoyed with this whole thing because they see it as crucial.
Well, this is the French through their state energy company EDF, which is on the hook for financing.
No, absolutely,
this
absolutely.
Enterprise. Robert, the Prime Minister, the UK Prime Minister, that is said to have concerns on a security basis about China being involved in providing the UK's energy infrastructure. Is that a reasonable worry?
Well, 6 years as Home Secretary, in other words, Interior Minister, just has made her absolutely
it's not a job that's focused, it's not a job that's ever made a politician more liberal.
Yeah, that's right. Funny enough, Vince Cable, who was a former cabinet colleague when it was in the coalition, said that Theresa May was always doubtful about Hinkley C. And I think there are a lot of questions about Hinkley C. I agree that it's a hell of a point at which to jam on the brakes. But the technology has been questioned. It looks very old. There are various other alternatives have been mentioned. There should be a lot more smaller stations. Very little investment has been put into it. There's the adaptation, as you know, of the kind of nuclear technology in the next generation of Trident submarines. I mean, the power plants, they're being developed, and that has been considered. And the sort of rather clunky bullying that we've had from both EDF and France and from the Chinese on this seems to be very strange, because the point of why this story has come up now is this strange open letter from the ambassador to the UK of the People's Republic of China, saying, oh, you know, if you don't do this, things are really at a turning point for us, which is a very odd way to go about it at all. But sorry, just to sort of get, if I could exercise a bit of spleen, it shows you how awful Cameron was. I keep on saying this on Monocle, but he was awful at very big strategic decisions, because anything
that's why he no longer has a job.
There was a strategic, you know, whether it's Heathrow, an enormously important other infrastructure, anything that smacked of personal unpopularity, and he ran a mile. And this is another case of that.
Daniela, Robert refers there to this open letter written by the ambassador from Beijing to the UK, Liu Xiaoming, appeared in the Financial Times today. I'm a big fan of diplomatic euphemism, and especially in the leaden sledgehammer tones with which the Chinese tend to deploy it. He did speak of a crucial historical juncture, was his precise phrase, mm-hmm. and warned that mutual trust could be jeopardized. Now, translated into the common parlance, how do we read that from China?
I'm not sure I'm allowed to use this kind of words on Monocle. Mutual trust is the major issue here as well. I mean, everyone has been very cagey about this, but as Robert said, security is a major concern, and there seems to be suggestions that the Chinese could somehow, and come some kind of like James Bond style maneuver, build in infrastructure into the nuclear plant that would enable them to take it over remotely, to shut down Britain's energy, to like hold us to ransom. I'm in no position to judge whether this is plausible, but this is quite possibly one of the aspects that that Theresa May has taken has taken on board. But I mean, I think it's nonsense to talk about mutual trust. There isn't mutual trust between China and Britain. There are mutual trust between very, very few countries. I'm struggling to think of two. And
I know you're always reminded of this, aren't you? Every time one country catches another country, it's thought of as a friend spying on it, and everybody pretends to be outraged, as if everybody doesn't do that all the time anyway.
Well, no, absolutely.
The Brits and the Americans spy on each other.
Well, exactly my point.
And so they would. And so what sort of irresponsible...
What about Australia?
Anyway.
I'm not personally culpable.
But there is something, though, because it came up in another of these discussions, Andrew, that when we were discussing it with Isabel, we said Hinkley Point, it's a very odd thing. It is part of what would pass in the UK as the deep state, because civil nuclear power is deeply involved with the whole military effort, Trident, the submarines and so on. I'm quite serious. I do think that that's what May is hinting at, because they cross over there, they share research facilities, they share research conclusions. I mean, places like Harwell, places like Hinkley have been involved in this. And I think that they are really worried, but they probably know how to do it anyway and have done it, that this is the way that China would get into the system, which is totally shared with the US. But I think that's too elegant a proof, and I think she's just naturally very wary, particularly, as you said in your introduction, Cameron and his Chancellor, his Treasury Minister, George Osborne, were so gung-ho for closer ties with China, more Chinese investment in Britain, even if it meant selling the British steel industry down the tubes.
I mean, there are, of course, domestic political concerns. 25,000 jobs attached to Hinkley Point C over the next 10 years. I mean, Daniela, when push comes to shove, what do you think the Prime Minister will actually do? Do you think she's actually seriously considering pulling the plugs on this, or is she trying to leverage something out of China and indeed out of France?
It would be amazing if she was really going to pull the plug on it. As I said, right at this juncture, Britain anyway needs foreign capital investment. But certainly, this is not a good time to make the French hate us even more. And this is not a good time to alienate us from the Chinese as well. I mean, Hinkley might bring in 25,000 jobs, but I mean, I'm sure Chinese investment in the UK brings in 10 times that. Mm. They invest a hell of a lot of money here. And as ever, you know, you have to, as a leader of a country, you have to balance between how much in hock you're going to be in foreign governments and how much you need their investment. But Britain does need these large infrastructure projects, and governments, political leaders are going to continue using them as a signal policy, because they do bring in so much money and they create so many jobs. So if she was suddenly going to say, right, no more of this, I hope she has something pretty big up her sleeve to deliver in its place.
Okay.
It's more damned if you don't than damned if you do.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller, along with Daniela Pellad and Robert Fox. Coming up next, the freestyle diplomacy events at the Olympic Games.
The Big Interview, the show that brings you the fascinating life stories of some of the most influential people in the worlds of art and culture, business and politics, continues this week with Christophe Galfard.
Again, when you know suddenly why the sky is blue, doesn't take off the poetry of a sunset. It adds some beauty to it.
The science advocate, author and protégé of no less than Professor Stephen Hawking sits down with me, Robert Bound, to discuss the beauty of science, the importance of making the field more accessible and popular, and the role it can play in bridging differences.
Science doesn't care about your culture. It doesn't care about your skin colour. It doesn't care about your language. It is universal. It is human. And it belongs to everybody again. And it does bring opposites together.
The Big Interview with Christophe Galfard. Download it now at monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Daniela Pellaert and Robert Fox. And let us now turn to the Olympic Games in Rio, where, if you don't count the United States and China, both of whom cheat by having too many people living in them, Australia is presently top of the medals table.
I would say that
because we're great. Anyway, as seasoned Olympics aficionados, they will one day play Australian rules football at the Olympics, and we'll win that as well. There's a clue in the
name. No, you'll be banned.
Anyway, as seasoned Olympics aficionados will be aware, the chief joys of the early stages of the Games are taking obsessive interest in sports nobody sane cares about for 3.9 years out of every four, like handball, sprint canoeing and ping pong, and the political geostrategic metaphors, as the Games remind us of George Orwell's definition of sport as war minus the shooting. Now, there have been some excellent rows at this early stage of the Olympics, and we've still got a couple of weeks to go. My particular favourite, and Robert, I'll put this one to you for refereeing first. I enjoyed Australia's ruck with China over the swimming. This is where Mac Horton, who won gold for Australia in the 400 metres freestyle, called his Chinese rival Sun Yang a drugs cheat. China is now furiously demanding an apology. It's excellent.
They're not going to get one, are they?
No, they're not.
That's top of the range. But I do like the whole strange parallel universe of Olympics coverage this time, that you see these people sort of sweating away, and it's the verbal lack of dexterity, whatever that is, of the commentators as they get terribly upset as somebody completely unknown has been bounced out by the Russian. It would be a Russian yet again in the epee or the foil or whatever in the fencing, which barely would get a line in newspapers in this country outside the very, very specialist sporting press. But the one that really did cheer my heart was beach volleyball came home, of course.
Indeed.
To Copacabana, and there we are. So you know that I'd be up for that. But unfortunately,
you are referring to that photograph of Egypt versus Germany in the women's beach volleyball.
Yes,
and the notable differences in attire between the two teams.
Yes, yes, and that has led to some discussion too about the fairness of wearing a hijab and playing beach
volleyball. Well, I mean, it was the particular option of that player Doha El Ghabashi to wear a hijab, and it was a last minute concession by the IOC that you can play beach volleyball in a hijab. They had conceded in 2012. I have looked this up, that players can now wear more or less what they please to an extent. They're not actually enforcing,
as opposed to a thong.
They're not enforcing the bikini anymore. So we can assume that the German competitors chose to wear that. I mean, Daniela, did that photo actually tell us anything about anything?
Yes, it told us lots about social media, Facebook and Twitter. That's what it told us about.
Yeah, I rather suspect you're right on that.
Yeah, that's what it told us.
We should also discuss the photo that went viral of the two Korean gymnasts, which I hope isn't going to end badly for the North Korean. This is the South Korean gymnast, Lee Eun-ju, decided to take a picture of herself with her North Korean rival, Hong Eun-jong. Again, people sort of... Daniela, do you have any faith in the idea of the Olympics as this arena in which the whole world joins as one and teaches itself to sing, etc.?
Well, I'm going to shock you here, Andrew. I'm going to say that I have absolutely zero faith. The whole concept makes me rather queasy. And this whole South Korea-North Korea event is a great example, because people are like, oh, they had a selfie. Oh, why can't we just get along? Oh, you know, a nation divided. And the South Korean participant probably thought this was a great idea and a great sign of peace. But I doubt, as you said, I doubt it's going to play out like that for the North Korean. And that's what's so hollow and so shallow about all of this, sort of peace and love. And similarly, there's been, I mean, it happens every time that various other countries in the Middle East refuse to share
the traditional gestures of petulant pettiness towards Israeli competitors.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's particularly awful thinking it is the 40th anniversary of the Munich Olympics massacre by Black September. And the pettiness...
44th anniversary.
No,
it was 72, 44th.
Oh, 72, of course. Yes, you're right. The thing that's so sad about there's been an incident with Saudi Arabia, but particularly the Lebanese team not prepared to get on the same bus as the Israelis going down from the village to events. Oh, come on, you know, get over yourself. And that is not the Corinthian or Olympic spirit. But mind you, were we to go back to Sparta or to Delphi or Olympus, where these things, I'll bet they were up to all of this as well.
I think it's a little bit ridiculous. I wish we could all get along. I wish there was a peace treaty between Israel and Lebanon, between Saudi Arabia and so on. But this is all, I mean, this is an enormous, enormous distraction. And, you know, Jerusalem is delighted every time something like this happens. It allows it to lean back, fold its arms and go, look, oh, we're so reasonable. And all those people, all those Lebanese people, we were bombing them 10 years ago and they really just hold a grudge. And everything should be fine for the Olympics. Sorry, the Olympics is meaningless. And I think even if you're an Olympic athlete, you think, I want to be the best in the world. You don't want to think, I want to share a message of peace, love and brotherhood and sisterhood with the rest of the world.
I suspect you're probably right. I suspect, given the choice between winning a gold medal and sort of appearing in a cheery photograph with a notional national rival, most athletes are going to take the gold medal, aren't they?
Yeah, and I think that this really has changed over the years that I've been watching this, first of all, in black and white, now in glorious colour television, now in social media, is it's the professionalisation, and it has become so mean and picky. And I think that it's not in good shape, the so-called, forget the Olympic movement, the Olympic management. Look at the position they are over Russia and drugs, that they, you know, partially allowing them in for the main event, but being really quite tough and in an exemplary fashion in just banning the lot for the Paralympics.
It does seem a weird dichotomy, but the Paralympics seem to be a bit more sure of themselves on this than the IOC. Mm. Finally tonight, we should look at Germany, where a Chinese backpacker known only as Mr. L recently got more than he bargained for. Or you could say, in terms of budget travel, actually quite the result. Attempting to report his wallet stolen in Heidelberg, he filled in the wrong form and inadvertently claimed asylum. He was then sent to a refugee shelter where he spent 12 days and presumably the modest stipend awarded to others in similar circumstances. This story does seem to have had a happy ending eventually. He was helped out when bewildered officials finally got somebody from a local Chinese restaurant to translate, and he is continuing his European tour. Daniela, how easy is it to get enmeshed by bureaucracy when travelling in a place where one does not speak the language?
It's super, super easy. But, I mean, generally not as dramatically as that. I mean, that is a Hollywood or a Chinese film waiting.
And it will be. It will be.
I can't wait. I think
he kept on asking for his passport back, which no self-respecting refugee does.
I think it's impossible to avoid, but some countries do it better than others. I was trying to think in advance of this of all the sort of bureaucratic messes I've gotten into, and I think Russia and Italy probably top of the list, but much easier and some sort of pleasant to undergo through the process in Italy than Russia.
Well, having experienced both, the Italians at least manage the inefficiency with a measure of charm.
Oh, charm, style, and smiles. You know,
not so
have
much
you
in
been
Russia.
Arrested by a carabinieri sergeant in Syracuse?
Not yet.
Very, very unpleasant, because you've got, as they say, the old farts, when they sit on walls there, quando c'era lui, when he was around, with a capital H, always meaning the Duce. I was taking a photograph of the 16th century fortress, which this wretched carabinieri patrol decided was strategic. I was banged up for 7 hours. And the thing that compounded it, they discovered I was a journalist. Ho-hum, I wonder how they worked that out. And it was very, very nasty.
I bet you got a nice coffee, though.
I didn't. I did get a grovelling apology because they thought I had posh friends that might get them demoted. But
I was once given an armed escort by Carabinieri to the front of the taxi queue at Bologna Airport because I told them I was there to interview a racing driver who used to drive for Ferrari, which was a true story, but I was not actually anticipating that response. It was amazing. That's not a bureaucratic story. That's just a story
that's
of...
That's just showing off.
That is just showing off.
It is a bureaucratic story. The one was when I was arrested on the Iraq-Turkey border at Cizre for being Robert Fisk. And although Ataturk did introduce the Latin alphabet, they couldn't work out the difference between the spelling of Fisk and Fox.
I hope you sent him an invoice.
He was delighted.
I bet he was. It's getting way off topic, but many, many years ago when I was a teenage rock journalist in Sydney, a friend of mine was once thumped at a party by a member of a band I'd criticised in the mistaken belief that he was hitting me. So I dodged one there. In terms of bureaucracy, I will always think happily of the Indian Bureau de Change official who attempted to write down the serial number of every banknote he was giving me. He's probably still doing it. And on that note, that is all we have time for on today's Midori House. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Molly Ingleby. Our studio manager was Wei Dong Lin. There's more music next and more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. I shall also be your host for that. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Miller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye. We'll